Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 6th, 2005. This session, Moving Slabs of Rock, Plate Tectonics and the Origin of the Cascade Mountains, presented by Ralph Dawes in the Fireside Room. Disc number 2005-02. Let's listen in.
Dawes is me, and this is a geology session entitled Moving Slabs of Rock. Which is about tectonics, really, to put other words on it. And everyone here has at least heard the term. Some of you have heard a lot about plate tectonics. Because, I mean, we really are on continents that are moving across the face of the Earth. They can now measure it directly, or year by year, using global positioning systems, which are pretty much agreeing with what geologists and geophysicists have already figured out about how the continents are moving. So every year, the North America gets closer to Asia by a few inches or a few centimeters, which may not seem like much, but if you add it up over extended numbers of years, it starts to become a significant amount. And of course, coastal Southern California is on a different plate from the rest of us, which explains a lot about people in coastal Southern California. No, not really.
Well, it's established, isn't it, that all the nuts roll to the furthest corner.
So, but it's compared to the rest of, on the other side of the San Andreas Fault down there in coastal California, the outboard side, the coastal side, they're moving north, northwest, so sort of towards Alaska, a few inches a year. There's no scientific basis to the urban myth that it's going to break off and fall into the sea, but in terms of plate tectonics, it is moving an earthquake at a time, and a little creeping at a time, a few inches a year on the average, towards Alaska. That's part of plate tectonics. But what I plan to do tonight, since I'm assuming I have mixed audience knowledge from beginning to whatever, is I'll start with the basics, definition of what plate tectonics is, and a little bit about how it works. There's three parts. That's part one. Part two, focus on plate tectonics in the Northwest today. What's happening today, develop a bit of a model in your minds, I hope. And then we'll take it back to the North Cascades as they formed, because the rocks around here are formed during an earlier stage of the history of the Cascade Mountains, which also relates to plate tectonics, we now think. But a lot like, but also somewhat different from what's going on today. So that's where we'll end up with number three. So it used to be taught, and it's still true, as far as we can tell, that the Earth has, well, to make it as simple as possible, three basic layers. The crust, which is this layer that in reality is thinner than this pencil line compared to the rest of the Earth, and then slicing the Earth open and looking inside of these layers. The next layer down is the mantle, and this is approximately the scale for the mantle and the core. The core is pretty big. And this is the core. And they're different in terms of chemistry and density. The core is thought to be made largely of iron and is very dense, and so on. But for plate tectonics, we got to look at the layers a little bit differently, especially up towards the surface. Oops. Take it slow. Alright, the outer layers of the Earth for plate tectonics, it's just as important to know about the lithosphere and the asthenosphere. And then the boundary between, from that earlier diagram, between the mantle and the crust are up here in the lithosphere. Can't seem to avoid the squeaking. So this is the crust on top still. This is the uppermost mantle from here on down to the core. You can see my scribbling. So no more chairs. And then who's heard, because I know some people, not including Don Rand or Cheryl, but who's heard of why the lithosphere is worth distinguishing as opposed to the crust and the mantle? Why put the crust together with this uppermost layer of the mantle? I remember hearing about why. It's for the mechanical behavior. The lithosphere is relatively strong and rigid all the way down to the base of this part of the outer mantle. So the crust is pretty much locked in with this part of the mantle, making a rigid layer. The rigid, strong outer layer of the Earth. Put it that way. Oh, let's speak in
the window. Maybe a better one.
Thanks.
Here's the
color. Yeah. So instead of thinking in terms of chemistry, the lithosphere is distinguished from what's underneath mainly in terms of its physics and its strength. It's relatively strong and rigid. And then the next layer down, going further down in the mantle, the asthenosphere is weak. It's from a Greek word, asthenos, for weak. I wonder if that means that aesthetic has to do with weakness, but maybe that's a different word. I don't know my Greek. And by the way, the asthenosphere is on the order, on the average, it varies in thickness, of something like 60 miles thick, let's say. Thicker than the crust alone. And then the asthenosphere up to as much as maybe a couple hundred miles thick. The bottom boundary is a bit of a gradation boundary into the lower mantle, we'll call it. Yeah, maybe it's just the way I write it. All right, so to talk about plates and plate tectonics, we're talking about the lithosphere and the asthenosphere, because the plates are what the lithosphere comprises. The lithosphere, this rigid outer layer of the Earth, is broken up into a bunch of plates. A dozen really big ones, several smaller ones, that together make up the whole outer layer of the Earth. So the lithosphere is the plates. It's not just a rigid shell, it doesn't go anywhere. It's rigid, but it's broken up into huge pieces up to thousands of miles across. And they're all moving. Every part of the Earth's surface is part of a plate that is moving somewhere. So there's no real fixed point on the Earth's surface, now some of you may have heard that plate tectonics theory was established as a theory in geology not until the 1960s, so most of us are old enough to remember something about when that happened. And it's certainly, it moved geology far along as a science, even though it was already a sound science beforehand, but it added a lot more insight into what we can do in terms of explaining how the Earth works, including the Cascade Mountains. So we got the lithosphere on top of the asthenosphere. The asthenosphere is pretty much solid, but it's, to use my non-technical terminology, squishy or very soft, and it can flow like a taffy can or some sort of putty can, it's solid, but you can squish it out and make it flow. It doesn't make it a liquid, it's still a solid, but it can deform like that, easier than the lithosphere can, although to some extent rocks in the lithosphere can flow too. You see that in the rocks around here. But the asthenosphere is thought to be flowing beneath the lithosphere as a way of bringing heat up from deeper in the Earth's interior. This whole thing, all of plate tectonics, is driven by heat coming out from inside the Earth. That's where the power comes from, that drives plate tectonics. It's the Earth's internal heat. And it's sort of like convection, where, like, if you have a pot of soup on the stove, even before it boils, the heat at the bottom of the pot of soup will make the liquid down there less dense, so it rises up. As it reaches the surface, it gives up some of its heat to the air up above and spreads out. And then it's now denser since it's losing its heat, so it sinks back in, and you get a convection cycle of this fluid moving up and down, bringing heat up, releasing heat, getting dense, and sinking back in. In a more complicated way, that's a lot of what is driving plate tectonics, a sort of complicated form of convection that comes up in the asthenosphere and spreads out, but also involves the lithosphere more directly than I'm showing here. Maybe I need another picture. Because if the whole outer layer of the Earth, known as the lithosphere, consists of plates, and they're all moving, then wherever two plates meet up against each other and you have a plate boundary, there's something going on there. And to reduce it to simple terms, and in a way the Earth reduces it to simple terms in the geometry and the physics of the way these plates have to move, there's divergent plate boundaries where the two plates move apart from each other. That's one of three types of plate boundaries. There's transform plate boundaries where the two plates move side by side in the opposite direction. Like here's two plates. Here's coastal Southern California. Here's the rest of North America. Side by side in opposite directions. That's a transform plate boundary. And then the third kind of boundary is two plates coming together. Well, they got to accommodate their collision somehow. And they're coming together a few inches a year, which geologically is relatively fast. So that's a convergent plate boundary. So we have divergent, transform, and convergent. And convergent can take on several forms depending on what's in the two plates that are meeting up with each other. Oh, I erased my picture. But I drew the lithosphere is thicker here and thinner here. The thicker part is where there's a continent in the lithosphere, and it's much thicker there and less dense. Continents are made of relatively low density rock, even though they might feel heavy to us. Oceanic crust is much thinner, only a few miles thick, and much denser than continental crust. So if two plates are coming together, and one of them, let's say one of them has a continent on its back in that area of convergence, and the other one has oceanic crust, then normally the one with oceanic crust is gonna meet up and decide who's gonna do what based on their density and their physics. The denser one's gonna go down. The one with oceanic crust is gonna go down. Let me back up for a sec. So we have three types of plate boundaries. Plate boundaries, not peanut butter and jelly. Divergent, two plates are moving apart. Transform, side by side, opposite directions. And convergent, two plates coming together. Okay. And I kind of mentioned this already. The San Andreas Fault is basically, it's a transform plate boundary. Two plates, the North American plate and the Pacific plate, moving side by side in opposite directions. But I was talking about convergent plate boundaries. And the easiest one to understand is if one plate is thinner, so we're looking, I've sliced into the earth this way, so we're looking at a cross section sideways. One plate has oceanic crust, so it's thinner. The other plate has continental crust, so it's much thicker. And when they meet up, the one with oceanic crust will be the one that goes down under the other one. Add more to it in a second. So this is going back down into the deeper mantle at this convergent plate boundary. And this is oceanic crust. And this is continental. This process of the plate with oceanic crust on it going back down, recycling essentially back down to the mantle, is called subduction. And I've left out a lot of complexities in here to keep it simple, but subduction is what's happening along the coast of the Pacific Northwest today. However, there's two other types of scenarios you can make up for plates meeting. Both of them can have oceanic crust. Well, if that happens, one of them is still going to subduct underneath the other. And it's still going to create the things related to subduction that we'll talk about in a second. The third possibility is that both plates have a continent on their backs. The continents are really thick, and they float on top of the denser rest of the Earth, so they're really light. So two continents meet up. One may start to force the other one down, but the one that's going down isn't going to go very far down because it's too light to stay down on the mantle. They're going to end up piling up and crumpling up near the Earth's surface, relatively, into a giant collisional mountain range. And that's what's happening in the Himalaya Mountains, where India is made of continental crust, of course, and it's on a plate that's shoving it like a bulldozer, or like a big wedge spread out sideways, into the rest of Asia. So the Himalaya Mountains are the bulldozer, the pile in front of the bulldozer of India, pushing into the rest of Asia. And that's different from a subduction zone that we're going to talk about a little bit more here. There are no volcanoes in the Himalayas. There's just faults where the rocks have broken and slid alongside each other.
to allow them to pile up and then giant folds and so on, and just a thickening of the crust. And then what happens after that is tremendous amounts of erosion go on to accommodate the pile up and the buildup of the mountains. So in the Indian Ocean, on either side of India, there are these giant bands of sediment spreading out into the ocean that's being eroded down and brought down by rivers out of the Himalayas. No volcanoes, they do have earthquakes though. That's part of that process. And I should back up a step. In my intro, I meant to say, the reason you probably at least have heard the term plate tectonics is because it shows up in the news every time there's a big earthquake, or most times there's a big earthquake, it's related to plate tectonics in some way. Not quite always, perhaps. And most major volcanic eruptions, with a few exceptions around the world, are related to these plate tectonic boundaries. So if there's a big eruption or a big earthquake, you might see a newspaper that has an extra section, like what's behind this earthquake or what's behind this volcano. And then you get a little three paragraph or maybe one page with diagrams on plate tectonics every time there's a big enough earthquake or volcanic eruption and a big enough newspaper to go into detail about it. Because these plate boundaries, including divergent and convergent, are where most of the world's volcanic activity occurs. And I'm not going to go into how it occurs at divergent plate boundaries tonight, but that's where a new oceanic crust is created, largely as a volcanic process. Because we're, I'll mention this much. If two plates are spreading apart from each other, what's happening in the middle? I mean, this may not be the exact physical model, but it's a way of thinking about it. Cracks keep opening up deeper into the earth, and molten rock keeps coming up to fill the gap, and that keeps creating new oceanic crust where the two plates are spreading apart. So divergent plate boundaries are constantly producing new oceanic crust, is what it produces, that thin, dense crust. And so much of the world's volcanism happens there, but of course it's mostly hidden under the oceans where you don't usually hear about it. It's a type of volcanism that's always going on, but it doesn't produce the kinds of eruptions that we're usually going to hear about. The other zone of volcanism related to plate tectonics is the subduction zones. So to add a detail to the subduction zone, every subduction zone in the world has a chain of volcanoes. Yeah, here's a smoking volcano. Above the subduction zone. And in every subduction zone, by analyzing the way earthquake waves go through and get refracted and so on through there, they can image this plate going down. A Japanese scientist, and I don't know where he's from, a European, I think, scientist named Wadati and Benioff figured this out over 50 years ago. So it's called the Wadati Benioff zone as far as the pattern of earthquakes going down. Anyway, they can see these plates in the form through what earthquakes tell us going down. So they know how deep the plates are under the volcanoes. And in every case, it's, I can't remember the number, on the order of 60 to 70 miles deep. So something happens in the subduction zone where the subducting plate, when it gets about 60 or 70 miles down to the mantle, it's producing molten rock that comes up and forms volcanoes in every subduction zone. And, you know, some subduction zones, it's going down steeper and the volcanoes are closer. Some subduction zones are going down less deep, and so for it to get 60 miles deep, the volcanoes are over here, above that zone where the magma, the molten rock, ultimately lava, is produced down inside the earth. Any questions yet? I'm being a bit disorganized, I feel like.
How is the measurement the 60 miles thick instead of 80 miles or 100? How do you get those measurements? Are they?
And actually, it's a little bit of variation. They vary from 60 to, say, 70 miles. Well, that's a little, the question in detail is a little bit beyond me because you'd have to ask a seismologist. Someone who can analyze earthquake waves picked up at several seismograph stations, and the details of, here's the analogy I make. How do you know what's in this room and where it is? By the way light waves reflect off it and reach your eyes, and you have two eyes so you can see three dimensions easier. Earthquake waves pass through the earth. They get refracted faster through the denser material, slower through the less dense material, and so on. They get reflected off some of the sharper boundaries in there, like light off a mirror or off a wall. And seismologists have figured out how to put that together into seeing things. Like this is a very dense slab in a, going down with a different speed of earthquake waves through it than what's around it. And they can image it that way. There's a second way they see it, actually, which is that this is a zone of earthquakes themselves. And they can measure the depth to the earthquake. So when they plot it out on a map in three dimensions, it's like, I mean, it's not all in a single plane, but it's a zone that's roughly planar like this. That's the Wadati-Benioff zone. The Wadati-Benioff zone was identified at least 20 or 30 years before the theory of plate tectonics was established, but it became a major supporting piece when they tried to put the whole thing together. So two different ways, but all pretty much based on earthquakes.
Is that what's happening in Mount St. Helens?
Yeah, Mount St. Helens is like this. It's above the subducting plate off that comes in offshore of Pacific Northwest here, which is what I'm going to talk about next. And now it's been a big question for those that are interested in what goes on down inside the Earth and ultimately how volcanoes form in terms of their sources inside the Earth. How does this connect to things like Mount St. Helens? When Mount St. Helens blew up in 1980, it was mostly water turning into steam that made it explode. And most of that water probably came from oceanic crust, which is all wet, of course, by the time it goes down the subduction zone. And when it reaches this depth of 60 to 70 miles, all that heat and pressure down there, you could say force water out of the rock, among other things. And the water actually helps melting of these hot rocks already down here occur, and it ends up dissolving into the molten rock, which is less dense, it's buoyant, so it works its way up. And ultimately, when it builds up into a volcano through a sequence of eruptions, and the water itself helps drive some of the eruptions, and some of that water probably sources all the way back to when this was out on the ocean floor. So it's water that's been recycled down and back up again. So we're talking about Pacific Northwest, and for that, there's a guy I saw give a talk once named Jay Tuzo Wilson, a great professor in terms of making major contributions to the theory of plate tectonics. And now I can't remember the name of the university in Toronto he was at. Canadian. And I saw him in his old age once briefly at a talk. But he says he figured out a lot about plate tectonics back in the 1960s. He was one of the major contributors by making paper cutout models on his desk and just moving things around. And of course, he also knew physics. He knew what the constraints were for how they could move. But so I don't have very many of these, but it's an example of what I do in my classes sometimes. This is as simple as you can get for looking at three types of plate matches. So also as low tech as you can get. So simple, you may wonder what the point is, but it's a triangle, so it has three points. So if anyone want to play with one of these, we're missing the tabletops, maybe we don't want to. But I'll show you how you run one of these, and then we'll build up what it means.
Usually I have students cut these out, but...
I bet you have to spend most of your afternoon.
Well, no, what was interesting was going around trying to find scissors, and since things are rare and hard to supply around here, and no one having scissors to leave their room. But Cheryl has some scissors in first aid kit. So this is a plate model. This is part of the Earth's surface. We plan it out into just a flat surface instead of a spherical surface, which simplifies it. And all this is two plates, plate A and plate B. Let's hold up here a minute. And to run it properly, all you do is you hold plate A underneath to the right, and then I'm going to slide it exactly sideways so it slides under plate B like that. Okay? That's all. It's very simple. Seemingly too simple. Okay? So, and there's a point to this you might not have seen it, I'll get to in a minute, but this illustrates three types of plate boundaries to begin with. Because if you run the model as instructed, best done on a flat table, of course, but plate A, over here, what's it doing compared to plate B? It's converging and going underneath. So it's a convergent plate boundary, presumably a subduction zone. All right. Now there's a symbol you see on plate tectonic maps for a subduction zone where you put triangles or teeth on the upper plate. So here we have a subduction zone on that boundary. Okay, now what's happening on this boundary? Side by side, opposite directions. Transform, yeah. Yeah, like the San Andreas fault. So this is a transform plate boundary. And then where the two plates, just another word for spreading apart here, we're trying to plate boundary
divergent.
Yeah, and the symbol for that is typically, symbol for a transform plate boundary is half arrow on each side showing which way things are offsetting relative to the other side. This is supposed to be a parallel double line for a divergent plate boundary. Okay. Now, it's very simplified. By the way, there wouldn't be a gap in here. More magma, more lava would keep coming up to fill the gap and keep forming new oceanic crust in here. And actually, it would be spreading this way too, but we won't go into that. It's a simplified model. This is also a simplified model of the Pacific Northwest and what's offshore. This could be taken as the Juan de Fuca plate. Which is the relatively small plate, only a few hundred miles across, off the coast of the Pacific Northwest, hidden underneath the floor of the ocean. This out here is one of the biggest plates in the world. Maybe it's the biggest. I think it is. The Pacific plate. So it goes way down across the equator and way up to Alaska and way over to the edge of Japan and so on. It's a big plate. And then over here is the North American plate. And so there's more boundaries I'm not showing here between the North American plate and the Pacific plate. So I gotta add those just for illustration. Here's the San Andreas Fault right here. See, it's like that and like that. And there's a fault off the coast of British Columbia called the Queen Charlotte Fault, which is a transform plate boundary as well. Like that. All right. So here's California. This is Cape Mendocino area in Northern California down here. It's what they call triple junction, where you have, here's a transform plate boundary meeting up with another transform plate boundary, the San Andreas fault zone, meeting up with a subduction zone. We'll give it its official name, the Cascadia subduction zone. And there's a chain of volcanoes that runs from southern British Columbia, and I'm not going to show them exactly, down to Lassen Peak inland and up a little bit from Cape Mendocino, California. Each of these is a similar type of volcano. Most of them have been active in the last few centuries, some in the last few decades. And they end exactly here and here, and that's not thought to be a coincidence. They are caused by the subduction zone. And so the Cascade Mountains are here. The nearest one of these mountains is Glacier Peak, which is where the crow flies, within about, what, 15 miles, 20 miles to the west. So that'd be like, you know, this one in my mess here. And Holden's right over here, slightly on the back side of it. Any questions about that? So that, this is the, you know, I didn't, if you look at the real map, you'll see a few zigs and zags compared to this one. So I've simplified it into a triangle, but this is the Pacific Northwest today with the Juan de Fuca plate coming in and subducting underneath the edge of North America here, causing the volcanoes, or correlated with them anyway. And I should mention causing earthquakes as well. This subduction process is not a smooth and well-oiled process. It builds up stress and then breaks, and a small or large earthquake can occur as part of how the subducting plate goes down. And most of the big earthquakes are going to occur along the leading edge of the subduction zone and to the west of the volcanic chain, the volcanic arc. So Western Washington has the bigger earthquake risk around here. The Cascadia subduction zone, let me just say a couple more things about it. It's one of the slowest moving subduction zones in the world. The two plates are not coming together as fast as some of the other subduction zones. That's probably one of the reasons why major earthquakes are less frequent here than some of the other subduction zones, but they still occur and will occur again in the future. San Andreas Fault down here, this transform plate boundary is moving faster and has more frequent earthquakes than we do up here. Sure, I remember at the University of Washington when there were, like in Loma Prieta earthquake 1989 and the Northridge earthquake 1994 in California, both led to phone calls from people in Southern California or the Bay Area. They called the geology department at University of Washington saying, are there earthquakes up there? We want to move. I remember we had to say, well, yeah, but not nearly as often as down there. And they're thinking, well, is that good enough? So,
are there small earthquakes happening every year?
Yeah. Ones they can pick up on the seismographs, yes. And they tend to happen on certain faults, you know, breaks in the rocks, where the rocks are shifting relative to each other. The ones that are below the level that you can feel yourself, but they can pick up on the seismograph instruments, they do tend to happen in certain areas more than others. Like the nearest one here I know of in eastern Washington is the, what's it called? I think it's the Antiat seismic zone. Kind of underneath the Columbia River on the other side of Lake of Chelan and down towards Antiat, there are a lot of micro earthquakes and occasional felt earthquakes, but nothing significant. So since 1872, when there was a major earthquake a little bit up from there, that they're not sure how powerful it was because they didn't have seismographs back then, but it was a major earthquake not that far from here. Yeah.
Where is that divergent?
The divergent plate boundary?
Yeah.
It's out in the ocean. I don't know the exact number. But it depends on which part of it you go to, but if you set out from the mouth of the Strait of Juan de Fuca or from the Pacific Coast, it's within 200 or 300 miles, I think.
We read about heard about a ring of fire, mm-hmm. going all around the Pacific, but there are volcanoes up in Alaska. They aren't related to this.
They are. The Pacific Plate down here is going this way. Stick Alaska in the way up here, and it's subducting underneath Alaska out through the Aleutian Islands and up into the Cook Inlet area. Up until then, it's a transfer and fault, but then Alaska bends out and comes out like this, becomes a subduction zone. So yeah, all those volcanoes up in Alaska are the same process. Japan, and then you get down to the Southwest Pacific. Well, okay, West Coast of South America, Southern Mexico and Central America, same thing, all subduction zones. It's not all the Pacific Plate. There's some other plates on the other side of these divergent plate boundaries that are spreading other ways. And then in the Southwest Pacific, there's a bunch of places where the two plates are coming together and converging. They both have oceanic crust, but one nonetheless subducts beneath the other and produces a chain of volcanoes in the form of islands that are volcanic, like the Marianas Islands, south of Japan.
And
Japan. The Hawaiian Islands, no. Okay. They're I guess they're not a total anomaly, but they're not a subduction zone. They're out in the middle of the Pacific Plate, and that's a whole other story, but there's the theory for them has a title known as the hotspot theory. There's a deeper source in the plate tectonic motion up in the asthenosphere and lithosphere. A source of heat is down deeper, sending up volcanic activity as the Pacific Plate moves across the top of it and produces this chain of a different type of volcanoes that became the Hawaiian Islands. It's very interesting also. But that's not the Ring of Fire. That's right in the middle of the whole thing. So,
what about isn't there a big fault in Illinois and Missouri?
You mean the Keweenawan Zone, down in the Missouri, yeah, the
New
Madrid Fault Zone.
Yeah,
which had a huge set of earthquakes in like 1800 or 1801, one of those years in the winter, when there were only a few, people in the area. And that's far from any plate boundary, at least in today's world. And it's hidden under all the sediments that have been dumped in there by the Mississippi River, the fault itself. But they can see it, by the way, earthquake waves pass through underneath, they can see something of it. There's a structure there, a fault structure, that is very large and extends from there south towards down the Mississippi Delta a little ways. I don't know everything about it. Is that probably a graben, Don, do you know, under there?
I don't know. I've heard a number of things. Some say it's a failed boundary of some sort that happens to be out in the middle of the plate.
Yeah, see, if you go way back in geologic history, in early that part of the North American continent may have ripped it apart as an earlier divergent plate boundary for the way continents tear apart leave these failed arms of the rifting process behind. So it may indirectly relate to plate tectonics, but it's far from any active plate boundary now. It's just this old zone of weakness. And this, it may still be getting activated even by the more sediment still piling from the Mississippi River, could be adding stress across the area. This old zone of weakness still acts up as a major earthquake center. Yeah, it's been 200 years since any huge earthquake occurred on that, but it could happen again. I'm not sure, you know, how long it takes for that one to build up stress, I don't think. There are some other examples of both volcanoes, like Hawaii, and earthquakes, like the New Madrid Fault Zone, that are far from any plate tectonic boundary and have either other explanations or when they're less directly tied to plate tectonics. Plate tectonics accounts for something like, well, let's just say the majority of the world's major earthquakes and the majority of the world's volcanic eruptions, but not all of them. There's some other things elsewhere. Okay, having said all that, to get to what's around here, around Holden and North Cascades, we need to add some details to what goes on in the subduction zone. Let me just messily sketch another subduction zone. And here's the continent next to it, well, like today. And this could be the Juan de Fuca plate going down.
Juan de Fuca.
Oh, Juan de Fuca. Let me write that down again. See, I'm from around here, so I think everyone knows this. Juan de Fuca was an Italian, right? An Italian explorer. No, I think he's actually Spanish.
Yeah.
Of course, he was Spanish. He was a Spanish person who wrote down a story claiming he explored the west coast of North America in the 16th century and described entering this major strait or opening, which they now call the Strait of Juan de Fuca out in western Washington, where Puget Sound opens up into the Pacific Ocean. Okay? There's, as I understand it, I'm not a historian, but there's some question as to whether he ever really made this trip. There isn't much other supporting evidence. But nonetheless, but he did give the latitude for this major opening into the west coast of North America that he found, and that's where the Strait of Juan de Fuca now is and has his name on it. And because every oceanographer that heads out to this area goes out the Strait of Juan de Fuca to get there, they ended up naming the main part of the plate, the Juan de Fuca plate. You know how names are, like America itself, instead of Colombia or whatever. But, well, all right, this could be the day again. It's going down. Here we are in North America, on the North American plate. What I want to mention is, this is the Olympic Mountains out to the west of Puget Sound, the Olympics for short, and these are the Cascades. The Olympics are not a volcanic mountain range. Those are over in the Cascades. But the Olympics are made of oceanic rocks that have been, you know, this is not to scale, but they've been somehow wedged in from underneath and added to the edge of North America as a form of accretion, a word they use in plate tectonics, which has about its usual meaning, growth by adding to the edge of something. Okay? So this subduction process accretes material from the floor of the ocean to the edge of the continent, stuff that doesn't make its way down in the subduction zone. And, okay, that's all that's going on lately along the northwest coast, but if you look out across the, you better go step. The Juan de Fuca plate is only a few hundred miles across, but there's evidence on the ocean floor that it's just a little remnant of a much huger plate that they call the Farallon plate, of these little islands off of San Francisco, that had thousands of miles of itself subducted underneath North America over the last more than 100 million years. Now, if you add up thousands of miles of subduction and look at an ocean and what's out sitting on the ocean floor, it's going to come in. If you could reel in a couple thousand miles of the Pacific Ocean now, it's not just going to be thin oceanic crust. You're going to find some islands or maybe even something the scale of Japan out there. And if the plate's moving this way and ultimately subducting underneath the edge of your continent, the thicker things, the islands, the Japans, the mini continents, they're not going to go down the subduction zone. Just like even some of the thin oceanic crust can, these bigger pieces are definitely going to somehow, either underneath or in some cases thrust on top, they're going to accrete to the edge of, in this case, North America.
Does that mean the coastal ranges are often just sort of scraped off the top of the subducting one? And then the larger ones are internal?
These ones here?
Magma thrusting up?
Yeah, that's a lot of it. I mean, that's a good way of putting it. A lot of scraping off. But when, if something in the scale of Japan came in, that would be more than just scraping off. That would be like a mini continental collision that would send stress a long ways inland and really, you know, and move the subduction zone, maybe the edge of the coast, outboard or further out a ways. And there's evidence that Washington State and Oregon and parts of southern British Columbia have been added in the last, well, this subduction zone, or the subduction process, maybe not exactly the same subduction zone, goes back along the edge of Western North America for no more than about 200 million years, a little bit less than that, since, have you ever heard of Pangaea, the supercontinent where all the continents were stuck together into one larger landmass? That started ripping apart on the order of 200 million years ago. And what's now North America started moving west as part of the rifting of Pangaea. Once it started doing that, subduction started happening along its west coast, or what's now its west coast anyway. So it's only since Pangaea rifted apart over the last 200 million years or a little bit less that this process has been going on the west coast of North America. And if that hadn't happened, if this was still part of Pangaea or if subduction hadn't happened, the coast would be over towards Spokane. All the stuff between here and there has been added in by accretion and other processes mostly related to plate tectonics. That's now become part of the theory for how continents grow, is one of the ways is by this accretion. And since I might run out of time pretty soon, let me just jump ahead. The rocks around Holden and the Holden mine, even though they got buried pretty deep in the crust and they got heated up a lot because of that, so they got metamorphosed. But before they got, so the metamorphic expert has to look at them and figure out what they used to be. Before they got metamorphosed, they were the kinds of rock that form on the ocean floor. Layers of sediment, basalt, which is the common volcanic rock on the ocean floor. So Holden is situated on top of a little bit of one of these accreted masses of rock that got, at an earlier stage, before the Olympics got here, going back a while, at an earlier stage, the subduction zone was further over. At least it may have been, there's some complexities here I'm not mentioning, but let's say the subduction zone was further over and accretion was happening in this area, adding rocks. Later, as the subduction zone moved out and the volcanic center became right here, what you have is a bunch of accreted terrains with volcanoes built in and on them. That's the Cascades today. So this volcanic chain known as the Cascades, not every mountain around here is volcanic, most of them aren't. Most of them are built out of other rock, including these accreted terrain material from a little while back.
Are any of these mountains right here that we name every day, are they volcanic?
No, you have to get up to Platy Pass and then you see Glacier Peak, and that's the nearest one. None of the others. And the nearest one from there is Mount Baker, 40 miles north or whatever. And the nearest one south is Mount Rainier. So the volcanoes are fairly isolated from each other. There may have been earlier between that earlier accretion and the present day Cascade volcanoes, there may have been some other volcanoes that have been eroded off, because, let me just wave my hands a little bit, with all this accretion going on and all the production of magma or lava inside the earth that the subduction process causes, there's been a lot of new material, a lot of new heat added to the area. So the Cascades, they're not just volcanic, they're also uplifting because of all the heat and the new low density volcanic type rocks that have been added. All that uplift has led to erosion of what was on top. So maybe here and there, there were some older volcanoes on top of what's now the Cascades, but they've been stripped away because of uplift and erosion since then. So all you see today is Mount Baker, Glacier Peak, and Mount Rainier. Near Mount Baker, there's this, but you know, kind of overlapping it, there's a slightly older volcano, but that's up by Mount Baker. Remember yesterday I was talking about those pseudo-volcanic rocks? There is that. I'm going to leave that aside. Because we only have about 10 minutes or however much more time you guys want, no more than about 10 or 15 minutes. What was I going to say? Oh, I didn't bring the rocks. Tomorrow, if any of you want to go up to the Mine Portal Museum, we'll have a chance to look at rocks and talk about how this rock was probably formed on the ocean floor to begin with as this type of sediment. And now here it is, this metamorphic rock in the middle of the North Cascades. These rocks do come in layers, just like piles of sediment on the ocean floor do, but now these layers of metamorphic rock are tilted up at high angles, because that accretion process really shoves things around. Fault breaks them along faults, folds them, and just shoves them up and tilts them. So you don't find any flat lying layers around here like they used to be when they were originally on the ocean floor. And you can't go very far. This is what the miners tried to do. So they have a layer that's full of copper. One of these layers of sedimentary rock or possibly volcanic rock from the ocean floor, they got a bunch of sulfides and copper and so on added to it, leaving those details aside till tomorrow. And they're thinking, okay, it's a layer. Like any layer of sediment, it should continue. You know, we can trace it out, so you go across the valley. It's going that way. Go across the valley and look for it. Didn't find it. It's going that way. Go up over the ridge and look for it. Didn't find it. It's a very discontinuous... Two things are probably going on, and Don, you might know more about this, having been here before. It could come to an end along a fault where things got shifted and taken off somewhere else. Or it could just taper out because the zone where the copper formed was this volcanic-related process where some fluids and some heat and some volcanic material got added to the ocean crust, maybe just in that one area. So they were pretty frustrated they didn't find more of it, but miners always are looking for it. They're always looking for an extension of the ore deposit and only sometimes finding it.
What would be the origin of a molten core?
In the earth?
Yeah, why?
Well,
what it makes me wonder is why isn't it coming out in more places than it really does?
Because it's too dense. Okay, we're still not getting the questions at this point, which is great. Okay, crust, mantle, core. I didn't mention, that the inner core is thought to be solid and the outer core is thought to be liquid because, and the outer core is liquid. And there's pretty, direct, strong evidence for this because there's a type of earthquake waves that won't go through liquid. And it comes to a dead stop right there at the boundary of the outer core. But the inner core is apparently solid. Well, there's good evidence for that. This is made out of, we've never been down there. It's too deep to get to, unless in certain science fiction novels. But it's, nonetheless, the evidence is good. It's mostly iron. It fits the dent. There's reasons to think so from astronomy and so on and how the planets form. It fits the density right and the properties right for it to be a mixture of iron and other things. So this, let's just call it an iron core. It's very dense. So there's no expectation that you'll ever get molten iron from down here up to the surface. Why it's molten is why any substance is solid or liquid depends not only on temperature but also on pressure. And as you go deeper in the earth, the pressure goes up and the temperature goes up. And at this range of pressures and temperatures, it's molten, but at the even higher pressures and not so much higher temperatures in the very core, higher pressure usually favors the solid form, so it gets squeezed back into a solid inner core. So that's the physics explanation why, in a nutshell. It's because of the heat down there, and only in the very inner core does the pressure get high enough to force it back into a solid. The volcanic rock or the molten rock inside the earth forms in the outer part of the earth, the asthenosphere and the lithosphere. There's processes that go on up there. Remember the asthenosphere? How it's squishy? It's not on the verge of melting. So if something disturbs it a certain way, it will start to melt, including adding water from the subducting plate or lowering the pressure on it. That will cause it to start melting. So the asthenosphere is always on the verge of melting, and if something changes it, it'll start melting. But that's way out here, just underneath the lithosphere. The one possible exception is hot spots that come from somewhere deeper. Some people think they do trace down to the core boundary in a way, but it's heat and gases that are coming up from that deep, not molten rock until, again, that process gets near the surface and causes the asthenosphere to melt because of the extra heat. That's my understanding of it. So you won't see the molten core of the Earth having any direct connection with this molten material to the Earth's surface. It's highly dense iron material that's not going to come out.
So coming out of a volcano, there's nothing.
What's coming out of a volcano comes from the outer layers.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Maybe
When you think of all the volcanoes that have gone off over the years, the lava, the basalt there is around, there must be an awful big hole down there somewhere.
Well, that's true. Well, but the remember in plate tectonics, two plates are spreading around part here, and more lava keeps coming up. But elsewhere, you got the subduction process that recycles it back in.
It has to come from somewhere.
Well, it's couldn't it be self-sustaining if it's recycling back in at the same rate as it's coming out?
Well, yeah, but do we know that really?
No.
There's a big hole down there.
Yeah.
Well,
I think when I started drilling for oil around Ellensburg, I don't know how many thousand feet of basalt did they go through.
Oh, yeah.
How about the basalt flows in the Columbia Basin in relation to plate tectonics?
The Columbia River basalt? All the basalt over in eastern Washington, mm-hmm. as you're talking about?
Yeah.
Questionable connection to plate tectonics. Behind subduction zones in the Southwest Pacific, there's a second, there's a back arc spreading center. Okay. One plate subducts beneath the other, and it sets up some sort of flow in the asthenosphere behind the subduction zone. That causes a little mini spreading and volcanism coming out behind each of those volcanic, ring of fire types, sets of volcanoes in the Southwest Pacific. So behind some subduction zones, there is basaltic volcanism coming out as a secondary result of the subduction process. Well, this is behind the subduction zone of the Pacific Northwest, where the Columbia River basalts came out in eastern Washington and northeastern Oregon and western Idaho. Is that also a secondary effect from the subduction process setting up a sort of backflow or back convection in the asthenosphere on the backside? That was one of the original suggestions after plate tectonic theory came in, that it might explain the Columbia River basalt. But the volume of the Columbia River basalt is so huge and so focused for the most part on this one zone that goes down into Oregon, and that it hasn't completely won the day as the explanation for, being caused by subduction, is on the backside of the subduction zone. And there's that huge pile of basalt is called flood basalts. And there's some other flood basalt provinces in the world. There's one in India, one in Siberia, one in South America, one in South Africa. And the other ones don't seem to show a connection to the backside of a subduction zone. So if it fits with those, it just kind of loses its connection to plate tectonics, apparently, in most ways. But maybe not completely. I mean, it's hard to prove what happened for sure down inside the mantle. The favorite, or at least the popular theory lately, is that it represents a hotspot, maybe the startup of a hotspot, just like it's underneath Hawaii now. Hawaii is this giant pile of basalt that goes way down to the ocean floor on top of what they call a hotspot. It's a plume or an uprising.
Like Yellowstone?
Okay. Well, if you trace the volcanic rocks, volcanoes basically, you can track a little bit south of where the Columbia River basalts erupted from. There's a volcanic center that started up at the same time as the Columbia River basalts started erupting. And then they get younger and younger from there in a chain up to Yellowstone, matching the direction of North America, North American plate since then, like it was going over a hotspot. Well, is that a coincidence, or did that hotspot also send a bunch of cracks out to the north with a bunch of lava coming up that created the Columbia River basalt? That's become a more popular theory in a lot of geologic circles lately. It's still hard to prove, but it's consistent with some of the evidence. So, and there's probably some other theories, but or at least hypotheses. But the two main competitors are back arc spreading related to the subduction zone, and then the hotspot theory for the Columbia River basalts that you run into as soon as you get past Chelan in the Columbia Plateau. So, other questions?
Hey, question. When I was a kid, I read a book that absolutely fascinated me. It was when I was laying around our house, and it was about Wagner's contributions in 1930, and about an American geologist that risked his career and his reputation with his colleagues, and went around and promoted Wagner's.
I don't know that American geologist.
I'm confused about something.
No.
The thing I really don't understand is, why is this theory so recent?
Well, it's a big book in itself.
There must have been a lot of shootouts among the
There was. Theories. Now, Wagner, his first version of his tome on continental drift, his big book, was in the 19-teens. like 1919 or 1916 or something, way back then. And he did come to a meeting of the I think it was the Geological Society of America in Washington, D.C. in the 1920s, I think it was. And, you know, the story is, now some of this is word of mouth through geologists since then, I haven't read a whole history book about it, that it was, I mean, it was supposed to be a debate about his idea of continental drift, but it was him against six or nine geologists in a row that were against it. And he wasn't a geologist, he was a meteorologist by training, you know, he studied the weather and the climate, but he just went off on the side and also studied continental drift. He had a lot of convincing evidence, the way the fossils matched up for a length of time, and then they didn't after that. The way the coastlines match, like a jigsaw puzzle across the Atlantic, etc. So he had, and because he had enough evidence in his favor, several geologists did, and some of them actually, he wasn't the first one to publish that. He was just the first one to write a detailed book with all the fossil and rock evidence, well, most of it summarized. So some other geologists already existed and overlapped with him who already were proponents of that idea. And then others came aboard after he published his book. Swiss, wasn't he one of them? A guy named, was he, I think it's...
I don't remember.
But that's not an American one.
I can't think of it.
And Du Toit, South Africa, the South African geologist.
Yeah.
Those are two names that come to me.
The foreigners were picked up on it much more than American geologists did.
Yeah, like look at the names. Some of his supporters are people that already had thought that, had names like Swiss and Du Toit and so on.
Well, he was German, though,
is that? Yeah, he was German. He was German. He died on a meteorological expedition out in the middle of the Greenland ice cap. He froze or whatever, got caught in a storm in the 1930s, I think it was. But the main reason, one reason his idea didn't catch on at the time was because maybe people are stubborn and don't want to change and want to protect their own, you know, research and reputation, and don't want to have to put it up to a revolution and change everything they've done. But perhaps another reason, but scientists try to be open to new ideas, even if they have to realize they were wrong in the past. So the other reason is, his was just continental drift, and he imagined the continents plowing like giant bulldozers around the face of the Earth. And when the geologist checked with the physicist said, no way, you can't move a continent like a bulldozer across the floor of the ocean. It wasn't until after World War II, using oceanographic equipment developed partly as anti-submarine warfare, they were able to measure things on the ocean floor and realize, wait a minute, it's not just the continents. The ocean floor itself spreads away from these places that we now call divergent plate batteries.
The discovery of the seams in the ocean floor.
Now you had something carrying the continents. And so once that came out in the early 1960s, they said, wait a minute, remember what Wegener said? Just stick the continents on the backs of these same plates and let them move with the spreading ocean floor, and it makes sense. And then they looked at these earthquake zones that went down like this, because they're going, okay, if new oceanic crust is forming and spreading apart, it has to go somewhere. Well, it goes back down in these subduction zones. So that it didn't come together until the 1960s, partly from technological advancements in oceanography.
So Wegener's idea was a pretty compelling
it was.
Notion.
Wegener got awfully smart after plate tectonics came along, because he had it hit just about right on the nose, the way, the timing and everything
was
remarkably accurate,
given
the fact that it was somewhat of a shot in the dark.
It was, and he didn't have the detailed measurements that they can do now. So the whole idea of Pangaea, that is largely Wegener's idea, and that's not thought to be correct. So, I want to mention one other rock type that I meant to bring up tonight, just before I let you go. Besides all the metamorphic rock around here that used to be sediments and basalts on the ocean floor and other things on the ocean floor, there's the other rocks you see around Holden are granites or things that are basically granite, but they give them other names like granodiorite and diorite. And that's because besides the accretion going on, any subduction zone is going to have those molten rocks coming up from below. And that's what forms all, it doesn't all erupt as a volcano. A lot of it sticks inside the crust as a big body of molten rock that turns solid down there to form a body of granite or whatever. So those are to simplify it, you see these metamorphic rocks around here that are thought to come from maybe thousands of miles away towards Asia from the floor of an older version of the Pacific Ocean, and then the intrusions that happen later as part of the subduction process to form all the granites.
You see the granites with the white lines going through them. What are the white lines?
Those are little dikes or intrusions that may have come a lot later when some more cracks opened up and a little more molten rock came up, or it may have been towards the end of the granite itself crystallizing. That molten rock has a lot of water dissolved in it usually. And as the crystals form that become the granite, most of the water gets left behind and what remains until finally it forms a separate solution of water and dissolved things that forces its way through some more cracks and cuts across what's already there in the granite and forms these late, they're called dikes. Dikes are these intrusions that cut across everything else. So any body of granite, you're likely to find some that formed late in the granite's history itself. But also, yeah, that's probably most of them. There's some other dikes around here that came even later, just from some further molten material coming up through cracks, but not in a big way, just in little cracks.
So. Is the total relative motion essentially constant, or is there a way to measure the rate of...
You mean of the plates Earth? Across the face of the Earth, or...?
Yes, I mean, in other words...
Yeah.
We stood one... because on that basis, still one place long enough, the same continent, you just saw what go by.
Well, there's a couple of interesting points. The total relative motion... I don't know that they've added up. You mean to see, like, all the continents can't be moving, or all the plates can't be moving the same way. They must average out to almost zero if you add them all up.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that one.
Really, the question is the rate of drift.
So, the segments don't move uniformly.
Yeah, they don't.
Some boundaries are, even I think across some boundaries, there are different parts of it move at somewhat different rates you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like your fingernails grow.
Since they've been able to stick a device that gets satellite reception and measure, is this part of the Earth really moving, like the plate tectonic says, they found that yes, the North American plate really is moving towards Asia, but parts of it are not moving the same speed as other parts. It's a little more flexible than they thought. But that's a detail, really. The larger question, let me put it this way. If you assume the continents on the moving plates are going to keep going the way they are now for tens of millions of years in the future, they're going to collide again, and we'll have a new version of Pangaea, and then apparently the Earth, to get its heat out and so on, is going to rip that apart again, and it'll break apart again in the future. And there's now thought to be predecessors to a Pangaea where that's happened at least once or twice before then. It's a several hundred million year cycle, so it's only happened a few times.
It's definitely going to impact property value.
Well, yeah. How long is your deed good for?
Don't worry, Dan, man.
We will never see Los Angeles floating by Seattle.
I was going to say, one neat thing about plate tectonics, once the oceanographers and physicists got involved in it, is they can apply just simple geometry to how plates, if you assume the plate's really rigid, moving like a single slab, then if you look at a triple junction and the way the plates are moving, they behave amazingly like the physicists would hope they would behave, and they can apply what's called spherical geometry to analyze how the plates are moving, and to the first approximation, it all made sense, and the physicists joined up with the geologists and made this plate tectonic revolution and the oceanographers.
So you could model all of that.
Yeah, until you get to the details, you find that some parts aren't moving as fast as they're supposed to, and it's like, is there a hidden fault under there? And then the geologists have to go back out to work.
But I suppose the motion is not only translation, but rotation, too.
Yeah, that's right. They use these what are called Euler poles. For if you have something moving across the surface of a sphere, if it's going to stay part of the sphere, you can imagine it's centered on a pivot point, like a bunch of strings are going to it, and it's like if this is a plate over part of the Earth, it'll keep it swinging together as a coherent unit, as if it's they really pivot or rotate as much as they move sideways, is what they think. Yeah. Well, thanks for staying with me for so long.
No, thank you.
Oh.
Thank you.
Well, we only have 8 minutes. But there's still 8 more minutes, I think, for ice cream, if you didn't have any already.